From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The name George Washington Williams, the black 19th century American soldier, clergyman, editor, writer, and lawyer, isn't exactly a commonplace. But one scholar at the National Humanities Center wants to change that. John Hope Franklin, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Chicago, is the author of several books about blacks in American history, including From Slavery to Freedom, The Militant South, Racial Equality in America, and The Illustrated History of Black Americans. At the center, Professor Franklin is writing a biography of George Washington Williams, whose historical trail Franklin has been following for nearly 40 years.
Who was George Washington Williams, and why are you stalking him? How long have you been after this man?
George Washington Williams was successively a soldier in the Union Army in the Civil War, a clergyman, an editor, a columnist. I think he was the first black columnist of a major newspaper in the United States. He was columnist with the Cincinnati Commercial. He was a lawyer, a legislator, the first black to sit in the Ohio legislature, 1881, a very interested civic leader and public servant. He was also a very serious critic of Leopold's policies in the Belgian Congo, and he went to the Congo in 1890, and he wrote an open letter to Leopold, and for the first time he pointed to the evils of European imperialism in Africa.
John Hope, tell me about the connection between George Washington Williams and King Leopold and the Congo, what is now Zaire.
Williams traveled all over, and on one of his trips to Brussels, he was introduced to the King, Leopold II, by Henry Sanford, who had been the United States minister to Belgium, and who was at that time just living in Belgium, and anyway, he had many, many business and other connections. And Williams, who's had a fertile mind and had always had projects going, and who had been interested in the Congo for some time and had written an article or two about the Congo, proposed to Leopold that what was needed in the Congo was a cadre of young American blacks who would go to the Congo, teach and train Congolese, and in other ways serve as a kind of model for the Congolese youth.
This is the Peace Corps.
It's exactly what it is. This is 1889 when he proposed this. And Leopold said he thought it was a good idea. And they talked about it some more, and Leopold said, well, go and get them, and let's have a go at it.
And how did it work?
Well, when Williams came over to the United States and began to recruit young blacks, they asked him questions that he could not answer.
You mean about the Congo?
About the Congo. Mm-hmm. He just didn't know.
And then that cooled their
desire?
And
he went back to Brussels. Mm-hmm. And he said to the King, he says, I can't answer all the questions that need to be answered, and I'm going to the Congo myself to see it. And Leopold said, oh, I don't think you need to do that. We have here information which will provide answers to any questions that you have. And William said, but I want to see it for myself. And Leopold said, no, it's the climate's not good, you might become ill, and so forth. And Williams began to realize then that maybe Leopold hadn't meant for him to go in the first place. And he became all the more determined to go, and they argued for a while. And then he left. determined to go, and he went to England and began to prepare to leave. What Leopold did not know was that by this time, Williams had made two important contacts, one with S.S. McClure of the Associated Literary Press, who had commissioned him to write articles on the Congo and would pay him for him, for them. The other was more even more important. He had met Collis P. Huntington, the president of the Southern Pacific Railroad, who was interested in Africa for various reasons, not the least of which was the possibility of building a railroad through the Congo. And Huntington, financed the trip. I discovered that by after many, many years, but running down the Huntington papers, which are now in the Syracuse University Library. So that Williams was able to go on his own without the king's permission, and certainly without his blessing.
And what was the upshot of the trip that he made?
Well, then he went, and he traveled 3,000 miles into the Congo, up to the headwaters of the river itself, up beyond Stanley Pool. And he met many tribes. He talked to many people. He had an entourage himself of a number of men who took his supplies and so forth. By this time, he has the money to pay them, of course. And when he came out, and the things he saw were just appalled him, such as the wholesale slaying of elephants to get their tusk. But worse still, the punishment of the Congolese themselves when they were disobedient, or when they were regarded as being disobedient, the punishment by severing a limb, a hand, or a foot. And he also was very much disgusted with Leopold's treatment of his own soldiers, the various military forces which he had stationed.
So this is why Leopold didn't want him to go in the first place.
One would assume that.
Yeah.
And when he came out, he wrote a long, open letter. It's called an open letter to His Serene Majesty, Leopold, King of the Belgians. And in this letter, which he published and distributed in France, in Belgium, in England, and the United States, even before he, Williams, returned, this letter caused something of a sensation, of course, in Belgium, where a special session of the Parliament was called, but also in other parts of the world as well. Another person who was in the Congo and on the river at precisely the same time was Roger Casement. Roger Casement was the great Irish diplomat in the British service, and who was there in 1890, and who saw a good deal that Williams saw, and who would go back later, some years later, and write the very, very important Casement Report, which is the way in which the British government officially found out all about the various cruelties and barbarities and inhuman treatment of Congolese on the part of Leopold in the Congo. The same sort of thing that Williams was saying in 1890. So there are Williams and Conrad and Casement, all interested in this problem, all in the Congo in 1890. Williams scoops the other two because he writes first. But what is so unfortunate is that they paid no attention to Williams. After all, he was rather, from their point of view, I suppose, rather insignificant black man from the United States, and who is he to say that Leopold is wrong? And yet, they all will come to that view in due course. When the Congo Reform Association was established some years later, and when Mark Twain became interested, when E.D. Morrell of Britain became interested, and all the others, then they came around to the point of view that Williams had expressed in 1890. But Williams, of course, didn't live to see his views vindicated, for he died in 1891.
It's odd, John Hope, that his name is not widely known. Or is it among scholars, for instance?
No, it's not widely known. When I was teaching at North Carolina College, now North Carolina Central University, some 35 years ago, I was in the stacks one day and reading the books on the shelves as I was wont to do, and I came across a large two-volume work called A History of the Negro Race in America by George Washington Williams, and I'd never heard of him before. And then I saw another book that was written by him, A History of the Negro Troops in the War of the Rebellion, published by Harper and Brother Harper and Company in 1887. Now, I fancied myself as being somewhat acquainted with history and historians of the United States in this general period of the 19th century, yet I'd never heard of him, and I thought very much that he deserved to be known about.
What is he writing about? I believe you've mentioned the contributions of blacks to American society.
Williams was particularly interested in the contributions of blacks to the military history of the United States. He held the view, as so many did who lived in the 19th century, that one deserved a favorite place in the nation if he had contributed to its security and to its well-being and to its independence and to its safety. So that Williams gives ample attention to the role of blacks, not merely in the Civil War, of which he made especially, but also in the War of 1812, in the Indian Wars, in the War for Independence, the French and Indian War before the War for Independence, etc. So that's one area in which he is very interested. Of course, another is the question of slavery, to which you referred. He's interested in colonial slavery, how it got established, how it spread, the slave trade, both foreign and domestic, and the institution of slavery as a place of control and limited assimilation. He's interested too in the education of blacks, and he gives attention to that problem before the Civil War, and of course in the post-Civil War years. He's interested in the role of blacks in Reconstruction, though in his History of the Negro Race he touches on it only lightly and explains that away by saying that he's engaged in writing a large work on Reconstruction. That work was never written, certainly never completed, and although there were rumors that it was about to be published, it never was published.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation with John Hope Franklin, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Chicago and a scholar at the National Humanities Center. Professor Franklin is discussing his biography of George Washington Williams, the black 19th century American writer, soldier, editor, clergyman, and lawyer whom Franklin has been stalking since 1945.
How did your sympathy for Williams develop?
Well, I was writing From Slavery to Freedom, A History of Negro Americans, when I first learned about Williams. And as I began myself to grapple with the enormous task of trying to write the history of a people from the beginning up to the present, including some African background, I began to appreciate the task that he had before him. I might have been a little better equipped to do it and the facilities might have been more available. But when one thinks of what he had to do and the limited skills and resources with which he had to do it in 1880, one becomes most impressed, and in my case, I became sympathetic as well.
John Hope, how does a professional historian like you separate himself from his subject?
Well, that's very difficult. And if anyone tells you it's not, you want to discount that statement to some extent. And this is particularly true if you've lived with a person, as long as I've lived with Williams.
Well, what are the dangers that you have to guard against?
Well, one has to guard against taking everything that your subject says without looking at the statement critically.
And how do you do that? How do you apply interpretive?
A simple matter. Williams gave his age when he enlisted into the regular army of the United States in 1867. He gave his age. He gave a certain age. He was born in 1849. I said, I don't know whether that's his age or not. One of the reasons I wondered about that was that I knew he had set his age forward when he went into the Union Army in 1863, because he wasn't old enough to be in the Army. And once you get setting your age inaccurately, or once you begin to lie about your age, there's a question of when you can stop doing it.
So you like him, but you don't necessarily trust him.
Oh, no, I don't trust him, and I think one must be very careful about that. I went back to the census of 1850 and was able to establish very clearly, unequivocally, what his age was, you see, so I didn't have any problem with that. But you then have to raise those questions from time to time. When he says he's going to do this, or when he says he has done this, if you have any way to check it, you'd better check it. I assure you that when I do finally publish this book, I'll be dead wrong about a number of things anyway, but I want to guard against that as much as I possibly
can. At least according to your critics.
Right.
John Hope, what about the desire that a historian may or may not have to secure in history a place for his subject? That must haunt you, I suppose.
Well, yes. One of the reasons that I was interested in working on Williams was that I thought that history had been unfair to him. That here was a man who, in 1890, in a poll taken from the readers of the Indianapolis Freeman, a fairly widely read black newspaper in the Midwest, the poll raised the question of who were the 10 greatest Negroes who ever lived. Not who were living then, but who ever lived. This would include Dumas, Hannibal, anyone. Everything was fair game. And in that list of 10, Williams was one. And yet, 5 years later, he was dead and forgotten. And I thought that a person who had done so much in the 41 years that he lived.
Only 41?
Yes, he was born in 1849. And he died in 1891, before his 42nd birthday. I thought the person who had done so much in such a short period of time deserved to be known, to be remembered, and indeed to be studied. For his career, spanning as it does such a short time, yet spans a very significant era in American history. The Civil War, the Reconstruction, the so-called Gilded Age, the period of the rise of major industrial enterprises in this country, the rise of philanthropy in this country, the rise of publishing, book publishing to the point where it was a major activity. that he touched on so many of these things in so many ways. And one can get a vision of America looking at it not through his history so much as through his career, his life, that it might give one a new way of appraising certain developments that occurred during his lifetime.
John Hope, how have you learned about George Washington Williams?
Well, it's very interesting that the longer one does research on a subject like this, the more people know about it. I have now a vast acquaintanceship that knows that I'm working on Williams. That's one way one gets information. But one can't sit back and rely on his friends. One has to get out and find it. And so I have done several different things. I have followed Williams wherever I have been able to do so. And I've been able to get a good deal of information. I've been to Ohio, of course. I've been to Massachusetts, of course, where he lived and where he worked for a number of years. I've even been to the place where he died, in Blackpool, England. My wife and I were in England a few years ago on our way to India, and I said to her, I said, you know, we haven't really got much on Williams's last days. One morning, I just casually mentioned to the head of the tourist bureau in Blackpool that I was looking for material on Williams, and I asked him where the newspaper office was, and he told me where it was. And then we chatted some more, and he says, well, I'll call them over here, and they can take you over there, and you can go into the newspaper files and see. And I did, I got a great deal of material, because although he'd been there only 3 weeks, he was sufficiently well known that the local newspaper had lengthy accounts of his illness and his death and his funeral. I said to this head of the tourist bureau in our conversation, you know, Williams must be here. When he died, he was not shipped back to the United States. He must be here. He said, well, we can find out. That's no problem. Within 5 minutes, his secretary had found that Williams was buried in Layton Cemetery down the road 1 mile in section F, grave 123. And he said, I suppose you're going. I said, well, I've been stalking this man for over 30 years. Of course I'm going. I've finally caught up with him. And so the newspaper man who had come over there said, I wonder if you'd object if I went along. And I said, not at all. He said, could I bring a photographer? And I said, that's all right, too.
So here was Williams and his ghost.
And my wife at that point said, you know, this is something of a happening. I think we ought to get flowers. And so we went by the florist and we got a wreath. And at the appointed hour, we went out and we met the photographer and the newspaper reporter there and the warden of the cemetery, dressed so properly in his black and white shirt and black tie. And we had a little procession down to section F, grave 123, and I laid the wreath on it. And the next morning, there was a big spread in the local newspaper about my stalking.
Is it fair to say, John Hope, that historical or cultural scholarship, the kind of work that George Washington Williams did, and by extension, the kind of work that you're doing in writing about Williams himself, does that have any noticeable impact on social attitudes or behavior? Do you feel that you are working removed, as it were?
No, one gets a feeling, as one reviews some of the history of this period, a feeling of déjà vu. For, after all, the problems that Williams encountered are problems that seem to persist. They certainly are problems that we have experienced in recent years in this country. When Williams was a member of the legislature in Ohio, he was refused service in the best restaurant in Columbus.
And that would have been in the 1880s.
1880, exactly. When Williams undertook to establish himself as a lawyer in the city of Cincinnati and later in the city of Boston, we find him experiencing the same problems. These aren't racial, I'm talking about now. The same problems that young lawyers would have in trying to get started, trying to build a clientele. When you see problems that are related to the American business enterprise system, the growth of business, the controls or the constraints that may be put on it by government, these were being debated in this period, and they are not unrelated to Williams's career. They were being debated then, just as we are debating them now. Deregulation and all the other things to constrain or not to constrain. Now, the point that I'm making is that that the problems of society tend to persist. I'm not suggesting here that history repeats itself. As a historian, I don't believe that. But the problems themselves persist. They stay with us, and the way in which they are confronted by one generation could have an impact on the way in which they could be confronted and perhaps solved or coped with by another generation. So that in that sense, it matters that we look at the careers of the Williamses of the 1880s and 90s. For there are Williamses in the 1980s and 90s who somehow will have to cope with their problems. And if they can find any suggestions of solutions from the ways that they were handled or were not handled in the earlier period, that seems to me to be an advantage.
Is it possible, John Hope, to surmise whether Williams would approve or disapprove of American society today, or is that useless speculation? Do you engage?
Oh, I don't object to speculating. I don't know whether it's useless or not. Williams was a man who loved life, and who loved life's challenges. He would have just been delighted in American society today, and he would have taken it on. And if he could do as much as he did in the 1870s and 80s, one could be certain that he could do a good deal with this society in the 1980s. I simply believe that he would have just had a great time, and he would have regarded this as a great ride.
John Hope Franklin is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Chicago and a scholar at the National Humanities Center. At the center, Professor Franklin is writing a biography of George Washington Williams, the subject of this edition of Soundings. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me this week for Soundings. My guest is the distinguished historian John Hope Franklin, a scholar at the National Humanities Center who's writing a book about George Washington Williams, the black 19th century American soldier, clergyman, lawyer, legislator, and writer. John Hope Franklin has been stalking Williams now for 30 years, and we'll be talking about his scholarly search. Please join us this week for Soundings.